please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Joe from York.
Well, thank you. My name is Joe Lear, and I am an alcoholic. First, I'd like to thank Dave for inviting me down to share with you guys. And I may say some things that some people may not agree with. And if you really have a problem with what I share tonight, I beg of you, don't come up to me after the meeting and try to straighten me out. Give me about 6 months, maybe a year. And if I'm still practicing the principles of AA, I might not believe none of that stuff, you know. So, and also, if you got any problem with what I share, you got to remember that Dave is the one who invited me out. So, please take all your comments to Dave. My sobriety date is July 26, 1991. That's just to let you know that I have a sobriety date. I think that's important. I think that anytime we stand up at a podium or share in an AA meeting, the least we could do is to give our sobriety date. It's not in the big book. It's just my opinion. I think that because there was a time when I didn't have a sobriety date, and I like to do a lot of talking in AA. And if I would have given you my sobriety date back at that time, you would have known exactly how long to listen to me. You know, because I used to think I had a lot to share. I had a lot to offer AA. And after I got a sponsor, I found out is what I had to offer AA is I was an expert on what not to do. Okay, I think a lot of us can relate to that. You know, we know it doesn't work very well. You know, a good friend of mine used to share it at the meeting all the time. He would say, as soon as I get an idea in my mind, I would run it until the wheels fell off. And then I would ride it on the axle just for a little bit longer just to make sure it wasn't going to work. Because I wasn't very good at, I didn't let go of ideas, old ideas, easily. And my experience is if you're like that, you're going to have a hard time in AA. Like I said, like was shared earlier, I'm from York, PA, originally from Baltimore, Maryland, and the home group that I belong to is the Roosevelt 12 and 12 group. It meets on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock. You're all welcome if you're ever in the area. We try to share our experience out of the 12 steps the way they're outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been to a lot of meetings where they do it out of the 12 and 12, and I got nothing against that. However, unfortunately, the 12 and 12 was written 15 years after AA got started. And what I come to understand is that was Bill Wilson's experience at 15 years sober. And I don't know about you guys. I like that idea. I wanted to get 15 years of sobriety in like maybe my first 6 months. I thought that would be a good idea. The advanced program of AA, you know, fresh out of a treatment center. You know, I was told when I left the treatment center that I had 1 year ahead of you guys. Man, I thought that was wonderful. And my sponsor was like an old timer, and you know, he wasn't in any kind of rehabs or treatment centers, and he wasn't quite catching on to that, you know. He really thought that I was new. You know, and I thought I knew something when I came into AA. I remember one time I was at a meeting, and it was an open discussion meeting, and my sponsor and I were sitting up front, and I beg you, don't let the jacket fool you, I'm an alcoholic. And I was sitting there with the jacket on, and my sponsor was sitting beside me, and some guy called him. He said, how about you up front with the jacket on? And my sponsor immediately says, he don't know nothing. You know, and I was eager to share. But my sponsor knew. He said to me, pulled me aside after the meeting. He says, Joe, you know a lot of things about a lot of things, but you don't know nothing about staying sober. And that's what this 1 hour is about. It's not about, you know, for you to come here and dump your garbage in Alcoholics Anonymous, or for you to come here and share your problems with the group. We have 1 hour to maybe, just maybe, connect with some alcoholic who's about ready to leave AA. Maybe to hopefully to try to give him some kind of hope that it doesn't ever have to be that way again. And I didn't always agree with my sponsor. But I tell you what, as I look back, that man loved me more than I was capable of loving myself. He said to me on many occasions, he said, Joe, I'd rather step on your toes than stand on your grave. And what that means is I'm going to tell you the truth whether you like it or not. And I was probably about 2 years sober, and I was sharing a meeting out in Baltimore, and my sponsor was sitting right up front of the meeting, and the lead that they had there was a 30-minute lead, and I was talking for about 20 minutes. I was 20 minutes into my talk, and in front of everybody, it was probably about the room, about the size of this, and it was pretty full, and right in the middle of my talk, my sponsor said, "I want to talk to you after the meeting." Like I said, I was only 20 minutes into my talk, and I was done. But I wasn't finished talking, so I finished talking for about another 10 minutes and have absolutely no idea what I shared. But after the meeting was over, he pulled me aside, and he said, "Where did you get that idea, which you were sharing up there at the podium?" And I didn't know which one he was talking about. Like I said, I was talking for about 20 minutes, and I didn't want to give the wrong idea, you know. And he could see that puzzled look in my eyes, and he says, "That idea of take what you want and leave the rest. AA is like a giant smorgasbord. You just come here and you pick and choose and you put your program together and you take what you want and you leave the rest." Man, as soon as I found out that was a bad idea, I blamed somebody else for it. That's what Dave was sharing last week at the meeting. You know, so just point the finger outside of myself. And he said to me, he says, "Joe, how did your life, just go out on a limb with me here, how did your life get to the point where you have no other choice but to be sitting in this meeting tonight? Just maybe. Maybe you have always taken what you want and left the rest. Maybe that's how your life got so screwed up." And I thought to myself, I didn't say it to him, but I thought to myself, well, that's one way of looking at it. It's not the one I would have picked, but the reality is, that's, to me, that's what alcoholism is. Alcoholism is what I found has a lot to do with drinking, but the reality is it has very little to do with drinking also. Because I don't know what my problem was in drinking. My problem was being sober. I had a huge problem with being sober. My problem always started when I stopped drinking. If I could have stayed drunk for the rest of my life without having any problems, you'd have a different speaker, because alcohol was never my problem. And I'm here to tell you that I have been to a lot of counseling, a lot of therapy, and a lot of treatment centers, and all of these places would tell me, if you would just stop drinking, your life would be so much better. And they had no understanding, in my mind, of what alcoholism is. Because when I stopped drinking, I become suicidal, homicidal. I just, life is very difficult. Life is painful. The past begins to catch up, and that's all I think about. You know, we wonder, by the time we get to AA, you hear it a lot talked about, that we have this racing mind, right? This mind that's always running. And I used to think that all that noise that was in my head was like what happened to me as a child, all the physical abuse and mental abuse. And, you know, many a times I remember trying to pull my stepfather off of my mother after he beat her unconscious, and just a horrendous childhood, right? And I would think that that's what all that noise is. And the great discovery that I made is that all of that noise that was going on in my head is what I was doing to the people around me. The hurts that I was causing, the lies and the stealing and my sexual problems and all of the other things that go along with alcoholism. And drinking solved that. I don't know what makes you an alcoholic. Maybe it's you drink too much, too long, and too often. That's never been my problem. My problem is, this is what I think an alcoholic, I could never get enough. I never knew what enough was. You can equate that with anything outside of drinking. But I'm an alcoholic, and I've done a lot of other things. I was raised on a farm, a 200-acre farm. We had a riding stable, and we had exotic animals. We had racehorses. And I remember being about maybe 9 or 10 years old, and we had this horse that was supposed to race on Saturday, and it was Friday. And my stepfather gave him, like, this stuff called butazolidine, 200 cc's. And that horse was lame the day before. The next day, he straightened right up. He ran the race, and he won the race. He ran so fast that he broke his leg. And I remember being about 10 years old thinking to myself, man, I'd like to get a hold of some of that. You know, because I was being chased a lot. I needed to run faster, you know. And that was long before I ever had my first drink. I was obsessed with a lot of things before I ever had my first drink. I was a liar and a thief and all of those things long before I took my first drink. All of that stuff was there. Drinking just, I guess you could say, was like throwing gas on a flame. But I was probably about 12 or 13 when I started drinking. It was a banquet, a showman's banquet for showing horses. And there was about 200 people at this banquet, and I knew most of the people there. And my impression at about 12 or 13, I would look around and I would look at these people, and I think to myself, they're a very miserable, unhappy lot of people. But this night they were all drinking and dancing and laughing and just having a good old time. You know, Bill was dancing with Bob's wife. Bob said, "Have a good time. Bring her back when you're done." You know, and my ears, little ears, 12-year-old ears perked up, little wife swapping going on. And he had a couple of more drinks, said, "Oh, hell, go ahead and keep her. Take her home with you." You know, and I remember there was a little girl sitting back in the corner. She was about 12 or 13. And I just wanted to ask her to dance. I just wanted to get up and do what I seen everybody else doing. But I couldn't seem to get out of my chair. So what I did is I started going around to all the tables. And I have absolutely no idea what I drank that night. I just know somewhere around the third or fourth drink, something happened. And you'll hear alcoholics say that a lot, that something happened. And it's what happened to me at the age of 13 is, as I look back there again, and it's like somebody took that 12-year-old girl out of the room and brought this 18-year-old model in. And I intuitively knew she wanted me. You know, she wanted me to come back there and ask her to dance. And I got up, and as a good friend of mine, Vicky, used to say all the time, I slithered my way on back. And I asked that little girl to dance, and we got out there, and we won a dance contest that night. I thought we invented dirty dancing at the age of 13, you know. Man, life was great, you know. And I got in a lot of trouble. I didn't realize, you know, you're supposed to wait till you get married to try to take their clothes off out on the dance floor. But I thought, you know, that's how alcoholics are. You know, we meet for the first time, and we fall in love, and we move in together, and some things never change. if you'd have stopped me that night and said, "Joe, what do you want to do with the rest of your life?" Man, I had the answer. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. My little 12-year-old mind was crystal clear. I wanted to drink this stuff, and I want to chase women. Now, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do when I catch them. But I'm going to have a lot of fun trying. You know, I used to think I caught my share. You know, but I used to wonder who got thrown back more. I suspect it was me because I always ended up alone, you know. And like I said, I got in a lot of trouble that night. I got carried home, and I guess my parents were going to try to teach me some kind of lesson because they put me in bed in what I was wearing the night before. And you ever notice that your parents, they can't wait to maybe 3 or 4 o'clock the next day to have a talk about your drinking? It's got to be 7 a.m. the next morning. Do you remember 7 a.m.? Everything hurts. And like I said, they were trying to teach me some kind of lesson. And I got up, they got me up, and I kind of took my inventory for the first time that morning. And I had this white silk shirt on, and everybody else was dressed like a cowboy at that place. And I had this white silk shirt on, and I looked down, and I realized somebody had thrown up all over me. And not only did they throw up on me, but they peed my pants, too. Yeah. And I don't know what kind of lesson my parents were trying to teach me, but I was a heavy smoker, and is what I found out later on is if you get the bed wet enough, it won't burn. You know? So maybe, just maybe bed wetting may have saved my life. So they were probably helping me along the way, and they didn't even know it. But they sat me in a chair, and they sat me there, and they says, "You shouldn't drink." My mother had never read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous up at that point. She said to me, "You're like a Dr. and Jekyll and Mr. Hyde when you drink. Everything about you changes. Your personality, the way you act, the way you treat people, the way you talk, just your demeanor, everything about you changes." I don't know if she said you have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, but she said you can't drink, you shouldn't drink. And I'm a little 13-year-old kid, and I'm hungover. And I'm not ready to argue that morning. And I said, "Mom and Dad, you're right, I shouldn't drink." But deep down inside, where the alcoholic lives, if you're anything like me, I said, "No shit, I changed when I drank." I didn't say that to them. I said that to myself in my mind. I said, "I like the change that happens to me when I drink. Don't drink? Man, I can't wait to do this again." Now, I'm not here to tell you that I was some kind of an instant alcoholic at that point. But I'm here to tell you from the age of 13 to the time I got to AA when I was 29, I pursued alcohol like my life depended on it. To me, that's what an alcoholic is. I needed to drink. I needed to drink in kindergarten, you know. Life would have been so much easier in kindergarten. You know, after I got sober, I got a sponsor. My sponsor liked to read the big book. You know what I mean? He didn't like to read those wordy pamphlets that we get from other places. And I like those kind of things. I like things like affirming myself. and he said, that's extremely self-centered, son. And I like self-centered before I got sober. But he liked to read the big book, and he would say things to me like, Joe, in AA, nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. And after listening to you talk for a little while, I suggest you work with thoroughness. And hopefully, honesty will catch up. You know, my sponsor has never called me a liar. But on many occasions, he suggested, strongly sometimes, that I may want to narrow the gap, you know, between the truth. You know, and he said, in AA, is what we do is we go back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. What is alcoholism and where did it start? Because that's what we got to treat when we get sober. Is what we do, if you're like me, when we come to AA, is we treat the wreckage, right? We look at what happened and all the stuff that's in front of us, and we're constantly treating that. Like the legal problems, the marital problems, the job problems. We're working on all of this outside stuff. And if you're like me, as a result of that, that stuff keeps happening. Right? He says we're going to go back to our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. And so what we're going to do is we're going to see where did this thing start. And I was probably about 3 or 4 years sober, and I'm trying to really take some decent inventory in AA. And I got it back to about between the third and fourth grade. That's where my problem started. And it's report card day. And the teacher's passing out all the report cards to all of my classmates and myself. And I noticed that my report card was the only one that was sealed shut. That's not a good thing, by the way. And the teacher handed it to me and says, you need to carry this home to Mom and Dad. I carried it home to Mom and Dad, and they opened it up. And they had that look of disappointment, one that I was going to come to know for many years. And it wasn't the grades that were the problem. It's the little notes that the teacher writes at the top. The first note says, your son does not play well with others. And I suspect many of us have had that problem. Good fourth and fifth step will bring that out. The second note, and this is important, your son cannot seem to follow simple directions. How many of us have ever had that problem? You know? And we wonder, why can't we seem to get sober when we come to AA? We just can't seem, if you're like me, we can't seem to follow simple directions. The big book is a set of directions. My sponsor said, if you do what's in this book, your life will never have to be this way again. And for some reason, we think we got to blaze our own path, you know? But it's what happened between the time I took my first drink in July 26, 1991 is what this alcoholic had to do in order to get sober is I had to drink every decent thing up on the outside. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I was married, had two kids, in the process of building a house out in Carroll County. And if you'd have looked at the outside of my life, you'd have thought this kid's got it together. He seems to be moving forward in life. And is all the alcoholic, if you're like me, is all I'm doing is putting on a show. And I didn't know this until I began to take my inventory. My whole life was based on what you thought. And that's sad. I mean, that's really sad. That's what my drinking was based on, never being able to measure up. Always being less than. Never feeling like I'm making it in this life. Looking at my life and comparing it to yours and wondering, why do I keep falling short? You know, and between 1988, the first time I went through a treatment center, and 1991 is what I did, is that my wife said to me one time, she said, if you keep drinking, this marriage is over. She seemed very sincere when she made that statement. I don't know why I thought she was kidding. But I just kept right on drinking, you know. My way of thinking, I got the alcoholic mind. How is she ever going to manage without me? Right? Isn't that how we think? Well, she had my replacement 6 months before I was out. So she had the new guy coming in before I was going out, you know, just being ready. I understand that. I got no problem with that, you know. The judge said to me, Mr. Lear, if you keep drinking, you are going to jail. I had like 4 or 5 DWIs up to that point. By the way, that's not, you know, a requirement to be a member of AA. I know tons of people who don't have any. But if need be, my sponsor said to me one night when I was telling him about that, he said, son, you really might not be an alcoholic. I said, I might not be, huh? You just might be a bad driver. I don't think that's true. I am a bad driver, but I do know that I'm an alcoholic. And the judge said to me, if you keep drinking, you're going to jail for a long time. And I don't know where in the back of my mind I thought to myself, how is the judge going to find out if I'm drinking? I mean, I'm not going to call him up and tell him I've been drinking, you know. And then because I had been coming around AA for a little while, this little voice in the back of my head says, he's going to find out the same way he did this time, Joe. I don't know about you guys. Cops never had to work hard to catch me. You know what I mean? I would look for one to do something. I was pulling out of a bar one night, and I hopped up over the curb because I couldn't find the driveway. and I ran him off the road. You know, and he was very, very upset. He pulled me out. Son, have you been drinking? No, sir. My theory to life is if you want the truth out of me, please don't ask me any questions. You know what I mean? As soon as you put pressure on me, you know, or put me under a spotlight or something, I got to lie. I just can't tell the truth. And so they don't have to work hard to catch me. And I went to jail, you know, and many of us, you know, would think that, you know, all the things that we go through should be enough to keep us from taking our next drink. I don't know what it takes for anybody to surrender. But is what I do know in AA, in order for us to get sober and to really stay sober and to recover, we have to make this surrender. And I think there's two parts to the surrender. There's not just one. And a lot of us, we come into AA, we make the first surrender to I'm powerless over alcohol. I made that admission for years, 5 years before I got sober. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that I couldn't drink one drink or it was going to set me off. I understood that. But the thing that I suffered from the most was I thought I could manage my life. And it's what I had to prove to me over the next couple of years is I cannot manage my own life. And is what the way that came about is I'm married, I got 2 kids, process of building a house out in Carroll County, and I hate my life. I hate my job. I hate my kids. I hate my wife. I would do things, just hateful things. Like I'd come home from work and I had a bad day at work. I guess they wanted me to work that day, you know, and I got home from work and I would say something to her real lovingly, like, you know, those 2 kids, they're probably not mine anyway. You know, just spiteful things. So she would say things to me like, why don't you just get out of here? Because I'm always looking for a reason to drink. If I can blame it on you, that's so much the better. Okay. So what happened is I lived like that, trying to not drink. This is when my problem started, coming into AA, kind of doing AA, half-heartedly doing AA, getting like a half a sponsor. And in case you don't know what a half a sponsor is, it's a name and a number. In case one of these people in AA with one of these badges on, okay, come up to you and say, do you have a sponsor yet? You can say, yes, it's Billy Bob or whatever it is, and I got their number. But we ain't going to call them. You know what I mean? We got the number and we got their name. But what I had to do is I had to get to this point of being drunk and being sober and hating both sides. I mean, really hating both sides. Hating everything about my life to the point where I ended up in the psychiatric ward because in this rage in my mind, I ran my truck into a pole. And I had a 100-pound bottle of acetylene and a 100-pound bottle of oxygen strapped in the back of that truck and they came into the cab. I didn't want to be here anymore. I wanted out. I wanted this fight to end, and I just simply didn't know how to end it. Okay? As I look back, I didn't want to die. I just knew that I couldn't keep living the way I was living. And you would think that that would be enough to keep somebody sober or to get them sober. Here's what my bottom is. My bottom is I'm laying in that psychiatric ward strapped down, and I'm more pissed off that I'm still alive. And my 2 little girls, they were 5 and 7. They came into that hospital room. And they just looked up at me and they said, Daddy, can't you promise that you won't do this anymore? and I couldn't even touch him. And as all I wanted to say is, I promise. But the truth is, I knew the truth at that point. I knew I couldn't make that promise. And I knew what I was going to do when I left there, regardless of how much I wanted to be sober or how much I wanted my life to be different. I knew that I was going to have to continue on that path. I didn't know what that path was or where it was going to end up. My brother was 29 years old when he died from alcoholism. He was 2 years older than me. They found him 3 days later under a car that fell on him. That's how we die. They didn't even go looking for him right away. Why bother looking? We always seem to come back, right? And I'm laying there, and I'm strapped in. I can't touch my kids, and all I want to do is tell them I love them and that I'm sorry, and I promise it won't be this way anymore, and I can't make that promise anymore. To me, that's my bottom. I knew exactly who and what I was, and I knew what I was capable of doing. I done drank everything up on the outside, but much more importantly, I drank anything good up on the inside. And it was probably another maybe 8 months to a year later before I was able to get into AA. I can't really tell you what happened in that period of time. I can tell you that I had to go to court. And in this courtroom, I was like 3/4 of the way down the docket. I was there for like my 50 WI and suicide and all this other stuff, and endangerment of other people, whatever. They thought I was trying to hurt myself. I informed them that I was not trying to hurt myself. I was trying to kill me. You know, there's a huge difference. I'm tired of hurting. But it's about 3/4 of the way down on the docket, and I'm watching all these people with lesser charges go in front of the judge, and they're going away for like 1 to 2 years. And my attorney, he was good friends with the judge. I mean, their families went on vacations together. Their kids grew up and went to the same schools. And my attorney kept saying to me, "Joe, we need to postpone this. You're going to jail for a long time." And this is where the main surrender happened for me. I was sitting in that courtroom and I said, "Paul," I said, "I am tired of postponing. Whatever happens, happens." I think that's a gift. I think for an alcoholic to finally come to a place where he's willing to accept the consequences for his own actions, there is hope to recover. Our problem is when we get to AA, we want it to be everybody else's fault. It seems like it would be so much easier if it was my parents' fault. But I said, "Paul, I'm tired of postponing. Whatever happens, happens." And it's what's crazy to me. At the end of that trial, I was the only one that didn't go to jail for not even 1 minute. I walked out of that courtroom with a man's name. And I was told, if I ask this man to be my sponsor, and I go to this one meeting down in Glen Burnie, Maryland, where I live, and I get that meeting as my home group, then my life won't have to be this way anymore. What is the hardest thing that we have to do in AA? I think if we passed around a basket and we just took a poll, what is the hardest thing you've had to do since you've been in AA? We'd have one basket full of the fourth and fifth step. We'd have another basket full of the eighth and ninth step. I think the basket that should be full is the basket of the first step. Because the hardest thing this alcoholic's ever had to do is to finally be beaten to a point where I had no other choice but to walk up to another man and say, "Would you please help me? Help me. I can't even help myself." And I'm not talking about the kind of help like right before you're getting ready to walk into a courtroom. Most alcoholics know how to ask for that kind of help. They actually got a name for it. They call it plea bargaining, right? Or the kind of help before she's getting ready to throw you out again, or he, whichever the case may be. They call that begging and pleading. And as all that really means for the alcoholic like me is, "I am sorry, until next time." Because you can be sure there's going to be a next time. I'm talking about the kind of help like you just don't know what's wrong anymore. Like maybe you've been coming around here for a while. Maybe you've been kind of doing the steps and kind of getting involved in AA, got a sponsor and kind of hem-hauling around a little bit and nothing seems to be getting better in your life. Because this was my experience. I thought, and you would hear it all the time, like, meeting makers make it. And that's very true. I mean, I would not want to get sober and stay sober without you guys. Okay? But I thought I remember when I first got my sponsor, the hardest thing I had to do was to ask him for help. And after a little while, we were talking, but he says to me, so tell me, Joe, what do you think the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is? And I laid out a long list of things that I thought it was, and because we were having this debate. Sponsors like it when you debate with them. They always win, okay? Because they're sober and you're not. And we were having this debate because I really believed in my sick alcoholic mind that I tried everything AA had to offer, and I would have said that it didn't work. And I believed that in my mind. It wasn't true, but I believed it. And I told him, I said, Tom, I've done everything that AA has to offer, and it didn't work. He says, well, tell me some of the things that you've done in AA. You know, I've been to the conferences and dances and conventions, and I've been to picnics and AA meetings and workshop, all kinds of stuff. And he says to me, well, it sounds to me like you've done everything except for the 12 steps. And that was the truth. I mean, I kind of did the steps. I believed I did the steps. I thought I did the steps when I was in that treatment center. I was voted out of my peers in that treatment center to be most likely to succeed in Alcoholics Anonymous. Man, isn't that what we're living for? To be, you know, you're the one that's going to make it. And I don't know any alcoholic that wants to make it in AA. I didn't want to make it here. I wanted to be something else other than an alcoholic. Because somewhere in the back of my mind, I wanted to drink again. I needed to drink again. And it's what I found is that and my sponsor knew this, I didn't know this. My sponsor knew if something doesn't change in here, if the pains of being sober get worse than the pains of drinking, the alcoholic has to drink. And my sponsor knew if something didn't change, that I was going to be leaving AA. Because there was times I liked AA. I liked going to meetings. I liked the people. I liked all of the things that went on around here. But for some reason, I couldn't seem to stay here. And my sponsor says to me, he says, don't let a spiritual awakening scare you out of AA. And the reality is that's what was scaring me out. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what it really meant to do a third step. I had no idea. I wasn't raised in any kind of religion, and I thought doing the third step was... I even told him, I said, Tom, I'm going to have to go to Catholic school for 12 years, you know, and get me some kind of education and understanding of God before I can do a third step. And he just laughed at me. He says, son, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, you know? He had went to 12 years of Catholic school, 4 years in the seminary, and here he is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what he told me is he found the God of his understanding in AA. Man, that's a powerful message for a guy like me. I knew that God has always been the answer. I mean, think about it. What happens when we finally reach that real dark place? I cried out to a God that I didn't believe in. I remember many a times when my life was so full of wreckage and my wife was ready to throw me out and the job was ready to fire me and I was going to go to jail. I remember many times going to the church and knocking on the door. Because I just wanted to ask him to please help me. Or at least tell me what's wrong with me. And I'd knock on the door, and as soon as I would hear somebody coming down the hallway, I would leave. Why? Because I knew I didn't belong there. I knew I was dirty. I knew I was sick. I knew if they knew about me what I knew about me, they wouldn't want to have anything to do with me. I knew what they meant when they were talking about the fourth and fifth step. And you know, is what I didn't understand when I got to AA is it's doing the fourth and fifth step is what gives me this relationship with God. Because without doing that, I can't form a relationship. Because those are the things that separate me. You know, I don't know why I thought those kind of thoughts. But my sponsor knew if something didn't change, and he thought it would be a good idea if we did these steps before I left AA. He would constantly talk to me that way. You know, like I'm leaving. Like I'd be sitting at the back or something like that. And he says, oh, are you a fire marshal now? You know, I'm new. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of people who may not be new sitting in the back. But I was new sitting in the back of the meeting. And he would say, are you a fire marshal now? And I think, well, I don't know. What is that? He says, well, that's in case this building bursts into flame. You can guide all these poor alcoholics to safety. Right? But what I was doing is I'm working my way out of AA. You know, I'm looking for reasons to get out of here. I would listen to a speaker talk. I knew I was an alcoholic and I knew my life depended on AA, but I was still looking for reasons to leave. To me, that's alcoholism. That's the worst part of alcoholism, and that only happens when we stop drinking, when we put the plug in the jug. And that's what I had to learn how to treat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And is what happened is I was probably about 3 or 4 months sober. And if you're like me and you're an alcoholic and you finally get a permanent address, right, for 3 or 4 months. It's got not permanent 3 or 4 months, it's permanent for us, right? And you get a permanent address for about 3 or 4 months, and they find out where you're at, and I don't have to tell you who they are, and everything begins to catch up. The past, right? I'm three and a half, 4 months sober in AA, and my sponsor had me up for the 8th and 9th step at that point. And the past began to catch up. The divorce papers were coming. The lawsuit papers were coming. The court papers. Just everything was coming. And here's what happened to me about three and a half, 4 months sober. I'm praying to a God that I really don't believe in, trust, or understand. I have a sponsor who I trust more than anybody else in this world. And I don't trust him that much either. But I trust him more than anybody else in the world. Right? I'm going to these meetings every day. I'm praying on my knees every morning, and I'm thanking God every night. And I'm 3 and a half, 4 months sober, and my past catches up. And for the very first time that I can remember, I knew I was going to be all right. That's never left. In all of this time, that has never left. And that doesn't mean that I don't have difficulties in my life. That just means I know I'm going to be all right. What are you looking for in AA? I've been looking for that ever since I can remember. That's what all of my drinking was about. You know, my drinking was about I just want to be all right. I want to be like I see everybody else. Everybody else seems to be going through life with no difficulties. I had one question when I came into AA. And I can assure you, not everybody in AA can answer this question. They'll come up with 1,000 different answers. And the question is simply this. How do you do this thing called life successfully without drinking? And you'll get 1,000 different answers. My sponsor said, here was my sponsor's answer. Put God in the center of your life and let everything else revolve around that. To me, that's what the 12 steps are about. We're crazy people. We want balance, right? I remember telling my sponsor, I was probably about 1.5 years there, but Tom, I need some balance in my life. And that's what that really meant, as I was horny and I was looking for a girlfriend. But I couldn't tell him that, you know what I mean? I need balance in my life, Tom. I didn't come to AA just to go to these meetings. I want to get a life or something like that. And he says, well, you had one of those, son. Look what you did with it. He said, if you want balance in your life, put God in your middle. Put God in the center. God in AA. And I say that to some people and they think, well, Christ, that must be all you do is AA. I have a full life. You know, I got remarried in AA. I got to a woman that I love with all my heart. You know, she's my best friend. You know, between us, we got 13 grandkids. You know, we both got started early. I think we were 12. You know what I mean? And so we got a full life. We have our own business. Just all this good stuff that comes our way. But I'm here to tell you, is AA first. I'm not here because I'm important. I didn't come all the way from York, Pennsylvania to share with you because I'm somebody. I have nothing that says that I have the answer. I came here because my life benefits by doing simple things like this. This is a small price to pay for what AA has given me. A very small price to pay. You know, I've been happy for over 20 years. And I've had a lot of bad things happen in my life. When I say happy, here's what I mean. The 12 steps have enabled me to live my life like it's none of my business. Man, what a gift that is. The 12 steps have enabled me to live my life like I don't have to impress you. It's not important what you think of me. My whole life was based on that. Everything about my life was based on living in fear and living my life based on how you reacted to me. Think how crazy that is. I mean, seriously. I'll be happy. Here's just a simple example. I'll be happy if I get her. Right? 6 months later. Man, I'll be happy if I get rid of her. Right? Man, I will be so happy if I get this career job. Man, a year later, Jesus Christ, I got to get the hell out. It's driving me crazy. I'll be happy if I'm out of here. And my happiness is always dependent on outside things being a certain way. And I'm here to tell you, life doesn't work that way. Life is life. The 12 steps have enabled me to simply look at it that way. Life does not happen to me. When I first got sober, I mean, we did a lot of reading tonight, and I remember whenever the 12 promises were read in AA, I didn't like them. I liked some of them, but with some of them I really didn't like. And they would get up to the one promise where it says, self-seeking will slip away. And I'm a newcomer sitting in an AA thinking to myself, that is going to have to slip away when I'm not looking. Because I'm going to be holding on to that. Self-seeking, that's how I live my life. Doing things to make me happy. The other one was, I disliked even more. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. And I remember being new thinking, man, I hope that never happens to me. You know? We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. That's the answer. The answer is to live outside of oneself. The answer is that, you know, if I can live my life based on what God thinks of me and what I think of me. My sponsor told me that early on. He says, Joe, you only need two votes in life. Just two. You need God's vote. And you've already got that because you're here and you're still with us. And your vote. Why are you withholding yours from you? You can do anything you want to do. You can go anywhere you want to go. You can be anything you want to be. Provided we're willing to live by some very simple spiritual principles. You know, like I was sharing earlier, honesty is not one of my virtues. Sometimes I don't even know what that is. I was married a few years. Actually, it just happened a couple of years ago. I get up in the morning, I'm probably about 18 years sober, and I get up and I get on my knees and I pray, right? And I do some of my reading and I begin to walk down the hallway, and my wife passes me in the hallway and she asks me a question and I lie to her. You know, I don't know why I lied. It just came out of my mouth. And I turned around and I started to go back into the bedroom. She says, "Hun, where are you going?" I says, "Well, obviously I got to go back in and pray because that first one didn't take." I just lied to you. And life is kind of like that. If I can learn to live from here rather than here, I don't have to lie. You know, just jumping back a little bit, when I was in that psychiatric ward, and they were asking me all of those questions, the only thing I could do was lie to those people. As much as I wanted help, as all I could do was lie because I knew they did not understand. They had no idea what was wrong with me. They just wanted to give me some kind of medication. And I'm not against medication. Not at all. My sponsor said to me, here, and this is kind, sometimes can be very tedious. When I got sober, my sponsor's idea was to turn the pain up. He said to me, he says, "Son, if you're not depressed about what you've done with your life, there is no hope for you." They call that a violent sociopath. Just nothing going on, no concerns about the past. I felt guilty when I got to AA. I felt ashamed. And I knew my mother was having me locked up one time, right? For stealing. The cops are putting the handcuffs on me. She's over off to the side, pointing me out. And the cops are putting the handcuffs on me, and I'm about half drunk, and I said, and I'm looking at her, I'm saying, "Mom, I'm your son, for God's sakes. Why are you doing this to me?" And she kind of put her head down a little bit. And you know what I did next? I laid into her. I said, "You blankety blanket, you're blanking fault my life so strong. I hate your stinking guts. I wish I was never born." And she began to cry and she walked away. You know what's ironic is I got to AA and I got to the ninth step, and my sponsor went over the eighth step list with me, and he says, "Where's your mother?" I said, "I never heard her." Right? I never heard her. And I told him that story. And he says, "Well, you told me the story about her having you locked up." I said, yeah, Tom, remember? She was having me locked up. And that's, isn't that ironic that that's as far as we can see? Is what they did to us. And here's one of the things that saved my life in AA. He said to me, he says, just go out on a limb with me, son. He'd like to talk to me that way. Like maybe allow me to think that he might be wrong. You know? And he would say, maybe is what you've done your whole life. Is you would push people, and you would push them, and you would push them to the limit to where they had no other choice but to either have you locked up, removed, put away, do something with them, get him out of here, and then you would blame them for the way your life turned out. And there is no recovery in that. The great thing that I found is that recovery begins when blaming stops, even for myself. I'm an alcoholic. I was probably about 5 years sober, and I was being a father. And somebody smart in AA came up to me after the meeting, and he says, it's about time you're doing the things you should have been doing all along. And that old guilt started to set in again. I can't live my life based on guilt. It just doesn't work. I'll do things that I don't want to do, and then I'll resent you for it. That's living my life based on guilt. And I started to pick that up again, and then I talked to my sponsor. And he said to me, he says, Joe, regardless of what you've done in your life, of how good or how bad it is, how heinous, I've done a lot of things that I'm not proud of. There's a lot of things that I will never share from the podium. They only belong in a fourth and fifth step. Okay? You had to do all of those things against your will. You had to do all of it in order to be here. Those things had to be done. That was your path to get to where you're at now. You need to learn how to accept that. To accept it does not mean that I'm condoning what I've done. To accept it means to be able to forgive myself for the past that I lived so I can be free of it, so I can live this new life. The book tells us we don't regret the past, but we can't live in it. That can't be what manages our life or directs us. We have to have a new path. And a new path, you know, I have no problem sitting down one-on-one with some new guy and just sharing my whole life story. To be able to maybe allow him to let go enough to maybe try to do something that he doesn't believe is going to work either. But it's what I believe with all of my heart is that I know that God loves me. And I'm not a religious person. I know that God loves me beyond a shadow of doubt. And I don't think that I'm special. I don't think that you hear sometimes, and I'm not here to critique anybody, but it may be your experience. This is just my experience. I don't think we're God's chosen people. My sponsor made it very clear to me that God chooses all. The difference between us and them is we choose Him. And the 12 steps have been a path which enables me to live that life. You know, this isn't difficult. You hear people, and I'm going to shut up with this, you hear people say in AA all the time, man, it's easy to practice these principles in Alcoholics Anonymous, but out there in the real world, you know, that's a different story. It's hard. Man, my experience is totally the opposite of that. It's hard out there in the real world when I don't practice spiritual principles. It's hard when I don't do it. When I do it, when I every now and then I luck into it, and maybe I'm outside of myself enough to think about somebody else or to maybe be able to take their needs and their concerns ahead of my own, man, life is so much easier. You know, I would like to thank you all for allowing me to come out and share with you tonight, and I'll turn the meeting back over. Thank you.